This is SG2 Perspectives, a conversation with industry experts and SG2 thought leaders about the biggest trends in healthcare and what we all expect that's going to mean for the future of healthcare delivery. Welcome to SG2 Perspectives. I'm your host, Trevor Durin, and this will be the second installment of a two-part series where we explore some of the biggest proposed payment changes from CMS and then let our subject matter experts react. Last week, we discussed proposed changes around site of care regulation, and today, we'll dig into virtual health reimbursement. First, you hear from our policy experts, Verlinda Rutledge, former hospital CEO and former leader of CMMI, as well as Leslie Camel from the SG2 Intelligence team. Then, we'll get into a reaction from Chris Pagano, who leads our virtual health team. Verlinda, virtual health is a tricky space because some part are the jurisdiction of CMS and others need to be adjusted through legislation. We're still hopeful for some legislative changes down the road, but this was the first clear indication of CMS's vision after the public health emergency of how they see virtual health going forward. What did we learn?
We always look at virtual health in three categories, and this is how CMS has defined it in the Medicare Physician Fee Schedule. They look at telehealth codes, and those are codes in which they reimburse the same as an in-person visit. Telehealth is governed under congressional legislation, and CMS has limited authority to change what falls under telehealth. Telehealth can only be reimbursed at rural areas, not as urban, and cannot have home as the originating site. So there's a geographic and originating site restrictions that can only be lifted by Congress. It has been lifted through the PHE, but after the PHE, unless Congress changes and has some legislation, CMS is very limited with the change. On the Medicare Physician Fee Schedule, they looked at some changes with telehealth. The second virtual health we want everyone to be aware of is the communication technology based. These are remote asynchronicity codes, and those are taking pictures and sending it to the doctor or having a text saying, should I come in? Those were codes that CMS set up a few years ago, and they cannot be paid at the same as in person. And then our third is remote patient monitoring. There's three types of virtual health: telehealth, communication technology based, and remote patient monitoring. With the telehealth codes, CMS said, we would love to continue to expand it. However, we're restricted by Congress. What they have done is they have category 1 and 2, and they had that for a number of years, and there's a process to put codes on for 1 and 2. But they add a category 3, which is saying it's only temporary. It will last until the end of the year of whenever the PHE ends. The PHE ends in February of 2021, you'll still have those category 3 codes until the end of December 2021. And they're hoping that they'll be able to expand those. Leslie, what was your takeaway with these new telehealth codes?
We certainly saw some interesting shifts in the approach by CMS of what they considered their authority to cover. A lot of the visits that were covered now under these new telehealth codes in category 1 and 2 were a lot of lower acuity E&M established patient visits, along with coverage for home visits under established patients, as well as some coverage for group psychotherapy, as well as psychological and neuropsychological testing. What we see with these codes is there is a push by CMS through physician fee schedule to increase coverage in those rural areas for telehealth and to really start to take some of the learnings and the application of broader telehealth use from the PHE into a post-PHE healthcare landscape. This is an opportunity for CMS to expand access, coverage, and the ability to cover more lives through telehealth than ever before. There is significant restrictions on what CMS can do without the help of Congress, but this is a positive start in the roadmap to expanding telehealth services. And here on the policy side of things, we are cautiously optimistic that there could be the start of more legislation towards telehealth coverage in a broader space beyond rural health. Melinda, would you like to tell us about the implications that you're seeing from the hospital side of this?
I hear from a lot of hospitals saying they really have put a lot of time and resources and infrastructure to make telehealth very effective during the pandemic. And they're worried about what's going to happen after the pandemic. And CMS has said, you know what? Our hands are tied. Unless Congress makes changes, all we can do is add codes for rural, and we cannot add any codes for home originating site except for substance use disorder. That was the one thing that Congress passed last year. A lot of people are starting to knock on the doors of congressional members, and many of us are hearing positive things about they would potentially take up some legislation to expand it. However, they are concerned about the potential for overutilization. So any changes that would allow expansion of telehealth beyond rural and allow home as originating site would have guardrails. So some of those guardrails could be it can only be an established patient, or there's only a certain number of telehealth codes that you could bill, or they have to come into an in-person visit per telehealth. We have no idea what those guardrails could possibly be. And certainly they have said they're not going to address it until after the election, and potentially could be during the lame duck session. Let's keep our fingers crossed that we're able to convince Congress the value of it. We talked about the communication technology code changes. Tell us a little bit, Leslie, about them and why they were put into existence from CMS.
We see that the communication-based technology code changes were significant, and there is a huge driver to include those who are able, clinicians, to provide these services using communication-based technology. We see that occupational therapy, physical therapists, licensed social workers are being added to those non-physicians who are able to bill for those services and provide them so long as there is supervision from a clinician, so a physician, which could have dramatic impact on access, especially for those ancillary services like physical therapy and occupational therapy, which could also improve convenience and access for millions of patients. Many Medicare beneficiaries struggle with access and timely reception of service. So these codes would allow for easier text or email exchange between a clinician and a patient so that those lines of communications are more open and more convenient for all involved. We have heard some pushback from many around the pricing of these exchanges, as many of them are priced in the $12 to $14 range, which can prove challenging for our members, particularly those providers who are performing these services at an ad hoc or on a smaller scale. If you look at a system whose multitude of providers are engaging in these communication-based technology exchanges, scale here would be an advantage in that they would be able to leverage a multitude of providers billing at these code levels, which would allow for a greater revenue stream to be maintained, as well as could provide an opportunity for seniors to get that more reliable stream of communication with their practitioner, whether it be an occupational therapist or even a physician.
In fact, I commend CMS to try real hard to continue to expand the use of virtual health. They know their hands are tied with telehealth. It can only be done in a rural and it can't be done in the home. So they've used this communication-based technology code as a way to allow the expansion. They're going to add the non-physicians, OTPT licensed social workers, because those can't be added based upon congressional legislation to telehealth. It can only be physicians that can bill under telehealth. They're also adding audio only. The telehealth legislation out of the Congress said it had to be audio video. So many people have shared with CMS that with some of the frail elderly may have a very much of a difficulty in accessing video. They don't feel comfortable in doing FaceTiming, Skype. This would allow audio only. Unfortunately, these codes cannot be paid at the same level as the in-person visit, because if they did, they would qualify as telehealth, which means it has to fall under Congress legislation. So CMS has said, we can't pay it at the same level. They've put the payment $12 to $14. Now, hopefully they'll reconsider that as time goes on, but communication technology codes can never be paid at the same level as the in-person visit. As our clients begin to take a look at how to implement communication-based technology technology codes, which we may be forced to do that if Congress decides not to change the legislation and expand telehealth. That could be our only vehicle to do telehealth. That's going to be really hard to find a return on investment.
Valinda, this certainly does pose a challenge for many. However, it is encouraging to see that CMS is taking such a proactive stance on trying to increase the different avenues that are at their disposal and that are within their regulatory authority to increase this access of these virtual-based services. And we're all very excited about this prospect.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the remote patient monitoring. Leslie, do you want to talk about some of the things that they changed with that?
We are seeing a huge change here within the remote patient monitoring span of what is now covered based on physician fee schedule. We are seeing that they have expanded the focus to allow coverage for acute conditions. This expansion of acute condition allows for a broader scope of patients to be treated and seen using remote patient monitoring technology. There is also the potential for this to allow for utilization during hospital at home or at hospital at home settings, which again would be significant for those Medicare beneficiaries. We also are seeing the requirement to use automated or live data upload technology. So this is a change because it was previously a function that was allowed for asynchronous or that non-live reporting. So you previously could use devices that would record the data and then had to be manually uploaded. Now there's the requirement that they be synchronous and allow for automated download. We will see there's now an opportunity for comment, and there are many across the industry that feel strongly that it does not need to be automated, while there are those who are in favor of it. So we will see as this proposed rule becomes final what feedback is given to CMS. Valinda, do you want to talk about a little bit what else we're seeing with remote patient monitoring in regards to the existing patient relation and what that has an impact on?
They did clarify, because there was some confusion previously, on what was the definition of the device. And they've said that it has to be an automated data upload. And people are pushing back on that because they feel technology, particularly some of the wearable devices, are moving very, very quick into the home setting. Some clinicians are saying having that automated data upload to a data hub is the only way in which you're able to bill for the device. There could be situations in which we literally want to have, in addition to that, some self-reported. And what the clarification of the rule says now is if it's not an automated data upload, they are unable to bill for the remote patient monitoring. They also said that they had to have an existing relationship with the patient. Now, during the PHE, they waived that and allowed a new patients. But now they're saying that it must be an established patient. The remote patient monitoring is the aspect that we all need to continue to take a look at. The technology is moving very, very quickly. We've seen some of the major technology companies moving into it.
And Valinda, if we think about the changes that remote patient monitoring is being proposed in this physician fee schedule rule, we see that there's the expansion of those who are qualified, so those with acute conditions. We see a change in the technology requirements, and we also see a change in those who are qualified based on existing patient relation or not. Wouldn't this pose some challenges in terms of those who would be eligible and kind of potentially creating some bottleneck in who can be accessible to this remote patient monitoring service?
I think that we're going to see more opportunities for us to use it. What do you think that we're going to begin to see in terms of new uses of this?
There could be a tremendous amount of use for those who are at hospital at home. There's also a great amount of chronic disease management that could be done for patients who have cardiac or other chronic conditions in which they have an existing physician relation, but then their physician or provider can get this real-time data to monitor the prognosis and the care episodes associated with chronic care conditions or even acute conditions. I see the potential for there to be a bottleneck, especially when an in-person visit is required to establish that relationship. Many of our providers are already struggling with an overwhelming panel size. We also know that many struggle to have an established relationship with a general practitioner, as well as there's the ongoing fears of coronavirus, the hesitancy to come in person and questions around safety, especially for many of our older patients, especially those who have pre-existing conditions. This will continue to be a challenge that maybe through feedback on the proposed rule, we will see some changes coming out of CMS to address that.
All right, Chris, now I want to get your reaction to all this. And full disclosure, we recorded the policy portion a couple days ago, so Chris had a chance to listen and now react. Any movement is positive in terms of making it easier for patients to access care virtually. I'll ask a few specific questions about each set of changes that CMS is proposing. Valinda and team really talked about limitations around what CMS can change related to telehealth originating site and reimbursement parity with in-person visits. Before COVID-19, reimbursement was probably the most common excuse of why virtual health wasn't being adopted really rapidly in a market. And we've seen kind of conflicting data, whether the really rapid increase in virtual health utilization around COVID and then the numbers coming back down, whether this data is going to help or hurt that argument. Chris, if we're going to make changes to virtual health reimbursement and regulation, what would make the biggest impact?
First and foremost, there's no question that there's certainly conflicting data out there on attitudes in relation to virtual health across the board. Ultimately, what I find in the data and hearing anecdotally is that patients want to have the full array of capabilities at their disposal and own their care journey. They want convenience, they want access, and they want high quality care delivered to them in a way that they're comfortable with and fits into their lives. I think that increasingly we're going to see that they're going to be seeking out organizations and physicians specifically who are willing to provide that. If you look at the numbers, between mid-March and mid-August, 12.1 million beneficiaries of Medicare fee-for-service programs, which for context is like somewhere around 36% of the total population, they use virtual health services this year. And obviously COVID was a huge part of that, but it didn't just occur during the initial surge of COVID. Now we're, I think, on the third surge or so, but it's persisted through the summer. And these are patients who are supposed to be the non-digital natives. They're the ones who are supposed to struggle with technology and want care in person. And I'm not sure that the data shows that that is consistently true. In terms of areas where permanent changes would be incredibly beneficial, you'll be unsurprised to hear me say there are many changes that would be really steps in a positive direction. I guess if I were to give you one or two that would be particularly impactful, the first one for me is the permanent removal of any originating site requirements or rural designations in relation to virtual health. That would be just such a monumental step forward if that was made permanent. This idea that only rural patients have challenges with access to care due to geography is just simply false. There are plenty of underserved communities out there in suburban or urban locales that have limited access to transportation, which is hindering their ability to receive the care they need. These are the underserved communities who often are disproportionately chronically ill, right? They have poor health outcomes, and frankly, they're costing hospitals and health systems a lot of money. And so virtual health, when done well, and when they're released of some of the regulatory restrictions that have been in place historically, they're able to help overcome some of these challenges. The second is going to be payment parity, right? No big surprise there. That would just be so incredibly impactful. And when coupled with the ability to establish the patient-physician relationship virtually, that would open up all kinds of interesting opportunities for organizations to enter into new markets, pursue a growth strategy, expand their reach, and perhaps even pursue different types of interesting, innovative partnerships. It would create a more competitive environment. I think we're headed there anyway due to the rise of some of these non-traditional entrants to the market. But I think it would provide a more diverse set of options for patients and create a lot of opportunity for innovation. So those might be where I'd love to see additional changes made moving forward.
Both of those make sense, and it's easy to see how broad the impact could be. There was really two changes from CMS, two buckets of changes that I want to ask you specific questions about. And the first is communication-based technology. And this is a positive step forward to address the digital divide you mentioned and to just make communicating with a physician easier and from a provider and health system perspective, make more of that care that in many cases is already happening and now it's reimbursable. That may be a small concern that there's going to be physicians or patients who say, we're already interacting in this way and now it's more formal and now there's a bill for it. That could get in the way. I'm a little nervous about that, but I think it's a small concern. I think it more opens big opportunities for smart user-centered design to expand access options. What's your take on the changes here and what the impact could be?
We've been speaking about this pathway since its inception a couple of years ago, and it definitely could be utilized by forward-thinking organizations to effectively support chronically ill patient populations and patients overall. There's going to be a really serious challenge for organizations to really put resources and really prioritize and be focused on this area. Given the incredibly low rates of reimbursement, there's other areas where at least right now, there's going to be more of a prioritization, and probably rightfully so, because every organization is really having to buckle down and think about where they're allocating resources and where they're focusing. And there are other areas that are going to be more perhaps beneficial here, at least in the short term.
The area I bet you want to spend more time in is around remote patient monitoring. Qualified conditions expanded. It now covers more acute conditions. On the surface, that says to me that's going to open up hospital at home options. What are you hearing from virtual health leaders about how much this really expands opportunities in the space?
There's no question that expanded opportunity to utilize virtual health in relation to hospital at home programs is fantastic. The changes that were made, including increasing, obviously, who can actually be the ones who are delivering care through these capabilities, that's an important first step. When we look at specifically home health, there are new opportunities to utilize virtual health as part of those home health programs, but there isn't appropriate reimbursement for it. So this could be a fantastic step forward, but for it to actually be meaningful, the reimbursement needs to be more appropriate in relation to the actual time and resources that are being devoted to these programs. Similarly, remote patient monitoring more broadly is an exceptionally important area for organizations to be focused in on. The issue I'm struggling with CMS right now, there was an area where they made a little bit of a misstep. Basically, CMS stated that interactive communication for two different CPT codes, 99457, 99458, that it involves at minimum a real-time synchronous two-way audio interaction. And then you can enhance that with video and other types of data transmission. But they stated that the interactive communication with these codes, it has to total at least 20 minutes of interactive time with the patient over the course of a calendar month for there to be reimbursement. What this essentially means is that there must be at least 20 minutes of interactive communication with the patient, as opposed to the interactive communication being a component of the overall 20 minutes of remote patient monitoring services that are being done in a month. This is different than how they've handled other services that are also utilized for chronic care patient populations, chronic care management services specifically. The issue is with those areas, CMS has been really clear that the time-based requirements consist of a combination of patient interactive communication, monitoring, and management of the patient's care plan. The reason that this matters is that CMS's current interpretation would basically mean that the practitioner and the clinical staff would have to use the remote patient monitoring technology, analyze the data, assess it, update the care plan accordingly, and also spend at least 20 minutes of additional time talking on the phone or having a video visit with the patient each month to get reimbursement.
Yeah, it really hurts scalability, right?
It does.
That's a great point to outline. So give me some closing thoughts around what all these changes mean cumulatively around your future outlook for virtual health.
Virtual health is not only here to stay. This is not a nice to have. This is a need to have. This is core to care delivery moving forward. Hospitals and health systems, they need consistency. There isn't a week or a month that goes by where I'm not seeing some sort of change of the regulatory environment for virtual health. And the bottom line is that a huge amount of uncertainty has existed around reimbursement regulations. And the unfortunate part about that is organizations have made significant investments in these technologies to serve their communities appropriately. And the uncertainty is incredibly challenging, especially as we think about the financial landscape that a lot of organizations are facing right now. Simplicity, forward-thinking approaches, and certainty is really what is needed right now from a legislative and regulatory perspective for organizations to continue to invest in the virtual health space.
Thanks, Chris, for sharing those thoughts and helping us be realistic about what some of these changes may really mean and what the impact may really be. Thanks to our listeners. Please subscribe or follow if you want to hear more. I always recommend other Vizient podcasts. The Modern Practice, it's on Vizient's Medical Leadership Channel and provides a clinical perspective into current issues affecting healthcare today. Everyone stay safe. Thanks for listening.
This has been another great episode of SG2 Perspectives, where industry experts and SG2 thought leaders explore the drivers of tomorrow's healthcare strategies to inform today's decision makers. Contact us anytime by sending an email to sg2perspectives@sg2.com. We'd love to hear from you. SG2 revolutionized healthcare demand forecasting with the Impact of Change forecast, and today we're the industry's premier strategy advisory firm. To learn more, visit sg2.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you again soon.